I didn't try to run back to the house, he said, returning in his mind to that distant night. He would have caught me before I'd gotten there, before I could use a telephone. Instead, I went up to the vestibule, out of the cupboard, through the file room, and turned right toward the front of the building, into the gallery. By the time I was on the stairs to his studio, I could hear him coming through the darkness behind me. I knew he kept a gun in the lower left-hand drawer of his desk. I'd seen it once when he'd sent me there to get something. Entering the studio, I hit the light switch, ran past his easel, supply cabinets, to the far corner. The desk was L-shaped. I vaulted over it, crashed into the chair, clawed at the drawer, got it open. The gun was there. I didn't know how to use it, whether it had a safety. My right hand was throbbing. I could hardly hold the damn thing, even in both hands. He was off the stairs, into the studio, coming for me. So I pointed and pulled the trigger. It was a revolver, no safety. The recoil about knocked me on my ass.
And you shot him?
Not yet. I must have pulled up hard on it when I squeezed the trigger. Pulled off target, so the bullet took a chunk out of the ceiling. But I held onto the gun, and he stopped coming. At least he didn't come as fast, not pell-mell anymore. But he was so calm, Ellie, so calm, as if nothing had happened. Just my dad, good old dad, a little perturbed with me, you know, but telling me everything was going to be all right, romancing me with that sweet talk, like in the black room. So sincere, so hypnotic, and so sure that he could make it work if I only gave him time. Ellie said, but he didn't know that you'd seen him beat your mother and carry her back to the barn 6 years before. He might have thought you would put together her death and his secret rooms when you came down from your panic, but until then he thought he had time to bring you around. Spencer stared at the black door. Yeah, maybe that's what he thought. I don't know. He told me that to be like him was to know what life was all about, the true fullness of life without limits or rules. He said I'd enjoy what he could show me how to do. He said I'd already started to enjoy it back in that black room, that I'd been afraid of enjoying it, but that I'd learn it was all right to have that kind of fun.
But you didn't enjoy it. You were repulsed.
He said that I did, that he could see I did. His genes ran through me like a river, he said again, through my heart just like a river. Our shared river of destiny, the dark river of our hearts. When he got to the desk, so close I couldn't miss again, I shot him. He flew backward from the impact. The spray of blood was horrible. It seemed for sure that I killed him. But then I hadn't seen much blood until that night, and a little looked like a lot. He hit the floor, rolled face down, and lay there, very still. I ran out of the studio, back down here. The black door waited. She didn't speak for a while. He couldn't. Then Ellie said, and in that room with the woman, those are the minutes you can't remember. The door. He should have had the old cellars collapsed with explosives, filled in with dirt, sealed forever. He shouldn't have left that black door to be opened again. Coming back here, he said with difficulty, I had to carry the revolver in my left hand because of how he'd clenched my right so hard in his, grinding my knuckles together. It was throbbing, full of pain. But the thing is, it wasn't just pain I felt in it. He looked at that hand now. He could see it, smaller, younger, the hand of a 14-year-old boy. I could still feel the smoothness of the woman's skin from when he'd forced my hand over her body. Feel the roundness of her breasts, the resiliency and fullness of them, the flatness of her belly, the crispness of pubic hair, the heat of her. All those feelings were in my hand, still in my hand, as real as the pain.
You were only a boy, she said, without any evidence of disgust. It was the first time you'd ever seen a woman undressed, the first time you'd ever touched a woman. My God, Spencer, in supercharged circumstances like that, not just terrifying, but so emotional in every way, so confusing, such a damned primal moment. Touching her was bound to reach you on every level, all at the same time. Your father knew that. He was a clever son of a bitch. He tried to use your turmoil to manipulate you, but it didn't mean anything.
She was too understanding and forgiving. In this blighted world, those who were too forgiving paid a cruel price for a Christian bent. So I came back through the catacombs with the dead all around me in the walls, with the memory of my father's blood, and still with the feel of her breasts in my hand, the vivid memory of how rubbery her nipples had felt against my palm.
Don't do this to yourself.
Never lie to the dog, Spencer said, with no humor this time, but with a bitterness and rage that frightened him. A fury welled in his heart, blacker than the door before him. He was no more able to shake it off than he had been able that July to shake from his hand the remembered warmth and shapes and sensuous textures of the naked woman. His rage was undirected, and that was why it had been intensifying in his deep unconscious for 16 years. He'd never been sure if it should be turned against his father or against himself. Lacking a target, he had denied the existence of that rage, repressed it. Now, condensed into a distillate of purest wrath, it was eating through him as corrosively as any acid. With the vivid memory of how her nipples had felt against my palm, he continued, but in a voice that shook equally with anger and with fear, I came back here, to this door, opened it, went into the black room. And the next thing I remember is walking away from here, the door falling shut behind me. Barefoot, walking back through the catacombs with a void in my memory more perfectly black than the room behind me, not sure where I've just been, what's just happened. Passing the women in the walls, women, girls, mothers, sisters, their silent screams, perpetual screams. Where is God? What does God care? Why has he abandoned them all here? Why has he abandoned me? A magnified spider shadow scurries across their plaster faces, along the looping shadow of the light cord. As I'm passing the new niche in the wall, the niche prepared for the woman in the black room, my father comes out of that hole, out of the dark earth, splattered with blood, staggering, wheezing in agony, but so fast as the spider, the hot flash of steel out of shadows, knife. He sometimes paints still lives of knives, making them glow as if they were holy relics, flashing steel, flashing pain across my face. Drop the gun, hands to my face, flap of cheek hanging off my chin, my bare teeth against my fingers, a grin of teeth exposed along the whole side of my face, tongue leaping against my fingers in the open side of my face, and he slashes again. Misses, falls. He's too weak to get up. Backing away from him, I pull my cheek in place, blood streaming between my fingers, running down my throat. I'm trying to hold my face together. Oh, God, trying to hold my face together. And running, running. Behind me, he's too weak to get off the floor, but not too weak to call after me. Did you kill her? Did you kill her? Baby boy, did you like it? Did you kill her? Spencer still could not look directly at Ellie, and might never be able to look directly at her again, not eye to eye. He could see her peripherally, and he knew that she was crying quietly, crying for him, eyes flooded, face glistening. He couldn't cry for himself. He had never been able to let go and fully purge his pain, because he didn't know if he was worthy of tears, of hers or his own or anyone's tears. All he could feel now was that rage, which was still without a target. The police found the woman dead in the black room, he said. Spencer, he killed her. Her voice trembled. It must have been him. The police said it was him. You were the boy hero. Staring at the black door, he shook his head. When did he kill her? Ellie, when? He dropped the scalpel when we both fell to the floor. Then I ran, and he ran after me. But there were other scalpels, other sharp instruments in the drawer. You said so yourself. He grabbed one and killed her. It would only have taken seconds, only a few seconds, Spencer. The bastard knew you couldn't get far, that he'd catch up with you. And he was so excited after his struggle with you that he couldn't wait, shaking with excitement. So he had to kill her then, hard and fast and brutally. Later, he's on the floor after he slashed me. And I'm running away, and he's calling after me, asking if I killed her, if I liked killing her. Oh, he knew she was dead before you ever came back here to free her. Maybe he was insane, and maybe he wasn't, but he was sure as hell the purest evil that ever walked. Don't you see? He hadn't converted you to his way, and he hadn't been able to kill you either. So all that was left for him was to ruin your life if he could, to plant that seed of doubt in your mind. You were a boy, half blind with panic and terror, confused, and he knew your turmoil. He understood, and he used it against you just for the sheer sick fun of it. For more than half his lifetime, Spencer had tried to convince himself of the scenario that she had just painted for him. But the void in his memory remained. The continued amnesia seemed to argue that the truth was different from what he desperately wished had happened. Go, he said thickly. Run for the truck. Drive away from here. Go to Denver. I shouldn't have brought you here. I can't ask you to come any farther with me.
I'm here. I'm not leaving.
I mean it. Get out.
No way.
Get out. Take the dog.
No.
Rocky was whining, shaking, huddling against a column of blood-dark brick, in torment as racking as any Spencer had ever seen. Take him. He likes you.
I'm not going. Through tears, she said, this is my decision, damn it, and you can't make it for me.
He turned on her, seized handfuls of her leather jacket, all but lifted her off the floor, frantically trying to force her to understand. In his rage and fear and self-loathing, he had managed, after all, to look her in the eyes one more time. For Christ's sake, after all you've seen and heard, don't you get it? I left part of myself in that room, that abattoir where he did his butchering. Left something there I couldn't live with. What in the name of God could that be? Huh? Something worse than the catacombs. Worse than all the rest of it. It has to be worse because I remembered all the rest of it. If I go back in there and remember what I did to her, there'll be no forgetting ever again, no hiding from it anymore. And this is a memory like fire. It's going to burn through me. Whatever's left, whatever isn't burned away, it won't be me anymore, Ellie. Not after I know what I did to her. And then, who are you going to be down here with? Down here in this godforsaken place, alone with? She raised one hand to his face and traced the line of his scar, though he tried to flinch away from her. She said, if I was blind, if I'd never seen your face, I already know you well enough that you could still break my heart.
Oh, Ellie, don't.
I'm not leaving.
Ellie, please.
No. He couldn't direct his rage at her either, especially not at her. He let go of her, stood with his hands at his sides, 14 again. Weak with his outrage, afraid, lost. She put her hand on the lever-action door handle.
Wait.
He withdrew the Sig 9mm pistol from under the waistband of his blue jeans, disengaged the safety, jacked a bullet into the chamber, and held the piece out to her.
You should have both guns.
She started to object, but he cut her off.
Keep the pistol in your hand. Don't get too close to me in there.
Spencer, whatever you remember, it's not going to turn you into your father. Not in an instant, no matter how terrible it is.
How do you know that? I've spent 16 years picking at it, prying and poking, trying to dig it out of the darkness, but it won't come. Now, if it comes...
She engaged the safety on the pistol.
Ellie...
I don't want it to go off accidentally.
My father wrestled on the floor with me and tickled me and made funny faces for me when I was little, played ball with me. And when I wanted to develop my drawing ability, he patiently taught technique to me. But before and after, he came down here, that same man, and he tortured women, girls, hour after hour, for days in some cases. He moved with ease between this world and the one above.
I'm not going to keep a gun ready, point a gun at you like I'm afraid you're some kind of monster when I know you're not. Please, Spencer, please, don't ask me to do that. Let's just finish this.
In the deep quiet at the end of the catacombs, he took a moment to prepare himself. Nothing moved anywhere in that long room. No rats, misshapen or otherwise, dwelt there anymore. The Dresmans had been instructed to eradicate them with poison. Spencer opened the black door. He switched on the light. He hesitated on the threshold, then went inside. Miserable though the dog was, he padded into that room as well. Maybe he was afraid to be alone in the catacombs, or maybe this time his misery was entirely a reaction to his master's state of mind, in which case he knew that his company was needed. He stayed close to Spencer. Ellie entered last, and the weighted door closed behind her. The abattoir was nearly as disorienting now as it had been on that night of scalpels and knives. The stainless steel table was gone, the chamber was empty, the unrelieved blackness allowed no point of reference, so one moment the room appeared to be hardly larger than a casket, but in the next moment it seemed infinitely larger than it actually was. The only light was still the tightly focused bulb in the black ceiling fixture. The Dresmans had been instructed to keep all lights functional. They had not been told to clean the abattoir, yet only the thinnest film of dust veiled the walls, no doubt because the room was not ventilated and was always shut up tight. It was a time capsule, sealed for 16 years, containing not the memorabilia of bygone days, but lost memories. The place affected Spencer even more powerfully than he had expected. He could see the glimmer of the scalpel, as if it hung in the air even now.
Barefoot, carrying the revolver in my left hand, I hurry down from the studio where I shot my father, through the back of the cupboard, into a world not anything like the one behind the wardrobe in those books by C.S. Lewis, through the catacombs, not daring to look left or right, because those dead women seem to be straining to break out of their plaster. I have the crazy fear that they might pull loose as if the plaster is still wet. Come for me. Take me into one of the walls with them. I'm my father's son, and I deserve to choke on cold, wet plaster, have it squeezed into my nostrils and poured down my throat until I'm as one with the figures in the tableau, unbreathing a harbor for the rats. My heart's knocking so hard that each beat makes my vision darken slightly, briefly, as if the surges in blood pressure will burst vessels in my eyes. I feel each beat in my right hand, too. The pain in my knuckles throbs, lub-dub. 3 small hearts in every finger. But I love the pain. I want more pain. Back in the vestibule and descending the stairs into the room of blue light, I repeatedly rapped the swollen knuckles of that hand with the revolver that I held in the other. Now I rap them hard against the catacombs to drive out all feeling but pain, because equal to the pain, dear Jesus God Almighty, I still have it on my hand like a stain on my hand, the smoothness of the woman's skin, the full curves and warm resiliency of her breasts, turgid nipples rubbing my palm, the flatness of belly, the tautness of muscles as she strains against the manacles. The lubricious heat into which he forces my fingers against all my resistance, against her terrible half-dazed protest. Her eyes were locked with mine, pleading with her eyes, the misery of her eyes. But the traitor hand has its own sense memory, unshakable, and it makes me sick. All the feelings in my hand make me sick, and some of the feelings in my heart. I have such disgust, loathing, such fear of myself. But other feelings, too, unclean emotions in harmony with the excitement of the hateful hand. And at the door to the black room, I stop, lean against the wall, and vomit, sweating, shuddering with chills. When I turn away from the mess with only my stomach purged, I force myself to grab the lever-action handle with my injured hand, making pain shoot up my forearm as I violently jerk open the door. And then I'm inside. Into the black room again. Don't look at her. Don't. Don't look at her naked. No right to look at her naked. This can be done with my eyes averted, edging to the table, aware of her only as a flesh-colored form out of the corner of my eye, floating in the darkness over there. It's okay, I tell her, my voice so hoarse from the choking. It's okay, lady. He's dead, lady. I shot him. I'll let you loose, get you out of here. Don't be afraid. And then I realize I haven't any idea where to find the keys to the manacles. Lady, I don't have a key. No key. Got to go for help. Call the cops. But it's okay. He's dead. No sound from her there, out of the corner of my eye. She'd been dazed from the blows to her head, only half conscious, and now she's passed out. But I don't want her to wake up after I've gone and be alone and afraid. I remember the look in her eyes. Was it the same look in my mother's eyes at the very end? And I don't want her to be so afraid when she wakes and thinks he's coming back for her. That's all. That's all. I just don't want her to be afraid. So I'm going to have to bring her around, shake her, wake her up, make her understand that he's dead and that I'll be back with help. I edge to the table, trying not to look at her body, going to look only at her face. A smell hits me. Terrible. Nauseating. The blackness is dizzying again. I put one hand out against the table to steady myself. It's the right hand, still remembering the curve of her breasts, and I put it down in a warm, viscous, slippery mass that wasn't there before. I look at her face, mouth open, eyes, dead blank eyes. He's been at her. 2 slashes. Vicious. Brutal. All of his great strength behind the blade. Her throat, her abdomen. I spin away from the table, away from the woman, collide with the wall, wiping my right hand on the black wall, calling for Jesus and for my mother, and saying, lady, please, as if she could mend herself by an act of will if only she'd listened to my pleas. Wiping the hand front and back on the wall, not only wiping off what I've pressed it into, but wiping away the way she felt when she was alive, wiping hard, harder, angrily, furiously, until my hand seems on fire, until there's nothing in my hand but pain. And then I stand there a while, not quite sure where I am any longer. I know there's a door. I go to it, through it. Oh, yes, the catacombs.
Spencer stood in the center of the black room, his right hand in front of his face, staring at it in the hard projected light, as though it was not at all the same hand that had been at the end of his wrist for the past 16 years. Almost wonderingly, he said,
I would have saved her.
I know that,
Ellie said.
But I couldn't save anyone.
And that's not your fault either.
For the first time since that ancient July, he thought he might have the capacity to accept, not soon but eventually, that he had no greater weight of guilt to carry than any other man. Darker memories, a more intimate experience of the human capacity for evil, knowledge that other people would never want forced on them as it had been forced on him, all of that, yes, but not a greater weight of guilt.
Rocky barked, twice, loud. Startled, Spencer said, he never barks.
Slipping off the safety on the SIG, Ellie swung toward the door as it flew open. She wasn't quick enough. The genial-looking man, the same who had broken into the Malibu cabin, burst into the black room. He had a silencer-fitted Beretta in his right hand, and he was smiling and squeezing off a shot as he came. Ellie took a round in her right shoulder, squealed in pain. Her hand spasmed and released the pistol, and she was slammed into the wall. She sagged against the blackness, gasping with the shock of being shot, realized the micro-Uzi was sliding off her shoulder, and made a grab for it with her left hand. It slipped through her fingers, hit the floor, and spun away from her. The pistol was gone, clattering beyond reach across the floor toward the man with the Beretta. But Spencer went for the Uzi even as it was falling. The smiling man fired again. The bullet sparked off the stone inches from Spencer's reaching hand, forcing him to pull back, and it ricocheted around the room. The shooter seemed unfazed by the whine of the bouncing slug, as if he led such a charmed life that his safety was a foregone conclusion.
I'd prefer not to shoot you, he said. I didn't want to shoot Ellie, either. I've other plans for both of you. But one more wrong move, and you'll take away all my choices. Now kick the Uzi over here.
Instead of doing what he had been told, Spencer went to Ellie. He touched her face and looked at her shoulder.
How bad?
She was clutching her wound, trying not to reveal the extent of her pain, but the truth was in her eyes.
Okay, I'm okay, it's nothing,
she said. Yet Spencer saw her glance at the whimpering dog when she lied. The heavy door to the abattoir hadn't fallen shut. Someone was holding it open. The shooter stepped aside to let him enter. The second man was Stephen Ackblom. Roy was certain that this would be one of the most interesting nights of his life. It might even be as singular as the first night that he had spent with Eve, although he wouldn't betray her even by hoping that it might be better. This was an incredible confluence of events. The capture of the woman, at last. The chance to learn what Grant might know of any organized opposition to the agency. Then the pleasure of putting that troubled man out of his misery. A unique opportunity to be with one of the great artists of the century as he turned his hand to the medium that had made him famous. And when it was done, perhaps even Eleanor's perfect eyes would be salvageable. Cosmic forces were at work in the design of such a night. When Stephen entered the room, the expression on Spencer Grant's face was worth the loss of at least 2 helicopters and a satellite. Anger darkened his face, twisted his features. It was a rage so pure that it possessed a fascinating beauty all its own. Enraged, Grant nonetheless shrank back with the woman.
Hello, Mikey, Stephen said. How've you been?
The son, once Mikey, now Spencer, was unable to speak.
I've been well, but in boring circumstances, said the artist.
Spencer Grant remained silent. Roy was chilled by the expression in the ex-cop's eyes. Stephen looked around at the black ceiling, walls, floor.
They blamed me for the woman you did here that night.
I took the fall on that one, too. For you, baby boy.
He never touched her, Ellie Summerton said.
Didn't he? The artist asked.
We know he didn't.
Stephen sighed with regret. Well, no, he didn't. But he was that close to doing her. He held up his thumb and forefinger only a quarter of an inch apart. That close.
He was never close at all, she said.
But Grant remained unable to speak.
Wasn't he? Stephen said. Well, I think he was. I think if I'd been a little smarter, if I'd encouraged him to drop his pants and climb on top of her first, then he would have been happy to take the scalpel afterward. He'd have been more in the spirit of things then, you see.
You're not my father, Grant said emptily.
You're wrong about that, my sweet boy. Your mother was a firm believer in marital vows. There was only ever me with her, I'm sure of that. In the end, here in this room, she was able to keep not the slightest secret from me.
Roy thought that Grant was going to come across the room with all the fury of a bull, heedless of bullets.
What a pathetic little dog, Stephen said. Look at him shaking, hanging his head. Perfect pet for you, Mikey. He reminds me of the way you acted here that night when I gave you the chance to transcend. You were too much of a pussy to seize it.
The woman appeared to be furious, too, perhaps even angrier than she was afraid, though both. Her eyes had never been more beautiful.
How long ago that was, Mikey. And what a new world this is, Stephen said, taking a couple of steps toward his son and the woman, forcing them to shrink back farther. I was so ahead of my time, so much deeper into the avant-garde than I ever fully realized. The newspapers called me insane. I ought to demand a retraction, don't you think? Now the streets are crawling with men more violent than I ever was. Gangs have gunfights anywhere they please, and babies get shot down on kindergarten playgrounds, and nobody does anything about it. The enlightened are too busy worrying that you're going to eat a food additive that'll shave 3.5 days off your lifespan. Did you read about the FBI agents up in Idaho, where they shot an unarmed woman while she was holding her baby and shot her 14-year-old son in the back when he tried to run from them, killed them both? You see that in the papers, Mikey? And now men like Roy here hold very responsible positions in government. Why, I could be a fabulously successful politician these days. I've got everything it takes. I'm not insane, Mikey. Daddy's not insane and never was. Evil? Yes, I embrace that. From earliest childhood, I've had it all in that regard. I've always liked to have fun. But I'm not crazy, baby boy. Roy here, guardian of public safety, protector of the Republic. Why, Mikey, he's a raving lunatic. Roy smiled at Stephen, wondering what joke he was setting up. The artist was endlessly amusing. But Stephen had moved so far into the room that Roy couldn't see his face, only the back of his head. Mikey, you should hear Roy rant on about compassion, about the poor quality of life that so many people live and shouldn't have to, about reducing population by 90% to save the environment. He loves everybody. He understands their suffering. He weeps for them. And when he has a chance, he'll blow them to kingdom come to make society a little nicer. It's a hoot, Mikey. And they give him helicopters and limousines and all the cash he needs and flunkies with big guns in shoulder holsters. They let him run around making a better world. And this man, Mikey, I'm telling you, he's got worms in his brain. Playing along with it, Roy said, "Worms in my brain. Big old slimy worms in my brain."
"See," Stephen said, "he's a funny guy, Roy is. Only wants to be liked. Most people do like him, too, don't they, Roy?"
Roy sensed that they were coming to the punchline. "Well, now, Stephen, I don't want to be bragging about myself."
"See," Stephen said, "he's a modest man, too. Modest and kind and compassionate. Doesn't everybody like you, Roy? Come on, don't be so bashful."
"Well, yeah, most people like me," Roy admitted. "But that's because I treat everyone with respect."
"That's right," Stephen said.
He laughed. Roy treats everyone with the same solemn respect. Why, he's an equal opportunity killer. Even-handed treatment for everyone, from a presidential aide wasted in a Washington park and then made to look like a suicide, to an ordinary paraplegic shot down to spare him the daily struggle. Roy doesn't understand that these things have to be done for fun. Only for fun. Otherwise, it's insane. It really is. To do it for some noble purpose. He's so solemn about it, thinks of himself as a dreamer, a man of ideals. But he does uphold his ideals. I'll give him that much. He plays no favorites. He's the least prejudiced, most egalitarian, foaming-at-the-mouth lunatic who ever lived. Don't you agree, Mr. Rink? Rink? Roy didn't want Rink or Fordyce hearing any of this, for God's sake, seeing any of this. They were muscle, not true insiders. He turned to the door, wondering why he hadn't heard it open, and saw that no one was there. Then he heard the scrape of the micro-Uzi against concrete as Stephen Ackblom plucked it off the floor, and he knew what was happening. Too late. The Uzi chattered in Stephen's hands. Bullets tore into Roy. He fell, rolled, and tried to fire back. Though he was still holding the gun, he couldn't make his finger squeeze the trigger. Paralyzed. He was paralyzed. Over the zinging, whining ricochets, something snarled viciously, a sound out of a horror movie echoing off the black walls with more blood-curdling effect than the bullets. For a second, Roy couldn't understand what it was, where it was coming from. He almost thought that it was Grant because of the fury in the scarred man's face, but then he saw the beast exploding through the air towards Stephen. The artist tried to swing around away from Roy and cut down the attack dog, but the hellish thing was already on him, driving him backward into the wall. It tore at his hands. He dropped the Uzi. Then it was climbing him, snapping at his face, at his throat. Stephen was screaming. Roy wanted to tell him that the most dangerous people of all, and evidently the most dangerous dogs as well, were those who had been beaten down the hardest. When even their pride and hope had been taken from them, when they were driven into the last of all corners, then they had nothing to lose. To avoid producing such desperate men, applying compassion to the suffering as early as possible was the right thing to do for them, the moral thing to do, but also the wisest thing to do. He couldn't tell the artist any of that, however, because in addition to being paralyzed, he found that he couldn't speak either.
Rocky, no! Off! Rocky, off!
Spencer pulled the dog by the collar and struggled with him until at last Rocky obeyed. The artist was sitting on the floor. His legs were drawn up defensively, his arms crossed over his face, and he was bleeding from his hands. Ellie had picked up the Uzi. Spencer took it from her. He saw that her left ear was bleeding. "You've been hit again." "Ricochet. Grazed," she said, and this time she could have met the dog's eyes forthrightly. Spencer looked down at the thing that was his father. The murderous bastard had lowered his arms from his face. He was infuriatingly calm. "They've got men posted from one end of the property to the other. Nobody here in the building, but once you step outside, you won't get far. You can't get away, Mikey." Ellie said, "They won't have heard the gunfire, not if no one above ground ever heard the screams from this place. We still have a chance." The wife killer shook his head. "Not unless you take me and the amazing Mr. Miro here." "He's dead," Ellie said. "Doesn't matter, he's more useful dead. Never know what a man like him might do, so I'd be edgy if we had to carry him out of here while he was alive. We'll take him between us, baby boy, you and me. They'll see he's hurt, but they won't know how badly. Maybe they value him highly enough to hold back."
"I don't want your help," Spencer said.
"Of course you don't, but you need it," his father said. "They won't have moved your truck. Their instructions were to stay back at a distance, just maintain surveillance until they heard from Roy. So we can move him to the truck between us, and they won't be sure what's going on." He rose painfully to his feet. Spencer backed away from him as he would have backed away from something that had appeared in a chalk pentagram in response to the summons of a sorcerer. Rocky retreated as well, growling. Ellie was in the doorway, leaning against the jamb. She was out of the way, reasonably safe. Spencer had the dog. What a dog. And he had the gun. His father had no weapon, and he was hampered by his bitten hands. Yet Spencer was as afraid of him as he had ever been on that July night or since. "Do we need him?" he asked Ellie.
"Hell no."
"You're sure whatever you were doing with the computer, it's going to work?"
"More sure of that than we could ever be sure of him."
To his father, Spencer said, "What happens to you if I leave you to them?" The artist examined his bitten hands with interest, studying the punctures not as though concerned about the damage, but as though inspecting a flower or another beautiful object that he had never seen before. "What happens to me, Mikey? You mean when I go back to prison? I do a little reading to pass the time. I still paint some, did you know? I think I'll paint a portrait of your little bitch there in the doorway, as I imagine she'd look with no clothes, and as I know she'd look if I'd ever had the chance to put her on a table here and make her realize her true potential. I see that disgusts you, baby boy, but really it's such a small pleasure to allow me, considering she'll never have been more beautiful than on my canvas. My way of sharing in her with you." He sighed and looked up from his hands as if unperturbed by the pain. "What happens if you leave me to them, Mikey? You'll be condemning me to a life that's a waste of my talent and my joie de vivre. A barren and tiny existence behind gray walls, that's what happens to me, you ungrateful little snot."
"You said they were worse than you."
"Well, I know what I am."
"What's that mean?"
"Self-awareness is a virtue in which they're lacking."
"They let you out?"
"Temporarily. A consultation."
"They'll let you out again, won't they?"
"Let's hope it doesn't take another 16 years. He smiled as if his bleeding hands had suffered only paper cuts. "But yes, we're in an age that's giving birth to a new breed of fascists, and I would hope that from time to time they might find my expertise useful to them."
"You're figuring you won't even go back," Spencer said. "You think you'll get away from them tonight, don't you?"
"Too many of them, Mikey. Big men with big guns in shoulder holsters, big black Chrysler limousines, helicopters whenever they want them. No. No, I'll probably have to bide my time until another consultation."
"Lying, mother-killing son of a bitch," Spencer said.
"Oh, don't try to frighten me," his father said. "I remember 16 years ago, this room. You were a little pussy then, Mikey, and you're a little pussy now. That's some scar you've got there, baby boy. How long did you have to recuperate before you could eat solid foods?"
"I saw you beat her to the ground by the swimming pool."
"If confession makes you feel good, go right ahead."
"I was in the kitchen for cookies, heard her scream."
"Did you get your cookies?"
"When she was down, you kicked her in the head."
"Don't be tedious, Mikey. You were never the son I might have wished to have, but you were never tedious before." The man was unshakably calm, self-possessed. He had an aura of power that was daunting, but no look of madness whatsoever in his eyes. He could preach a sermon and be thought a priest. He claimed that he wasn't mad, but evil. Spencer wondered if that could be true.
"Mikey, you really owe me, you know. Without me, you wouldn't exist. No matter what you think of me, I am your father."
"Without you, I wouldn't exist, yeah. And that would be okay. That would be fine. But without my mother, I might have been exactly like you. It's her I owe, only her. She's the one who gave me whatever salvation I can ever have."
Mikey, you simply can't make me feel guilty. You want me to put on a big, sad face? Okay, I'll put on a big, sad face. But your mother was nothing to me, nothing but a useful cover for a while, a helpful deceit with nice knockers. But she was too curious, and when I had to bring her down here, she was just like all the others, although less exciting than most.
"Well, just the same," Spencer said. "This is for her." He fired a short burst from the Uzi, blowing his father to hell.
There were no ricochets to worry about. Every bullet found its mark, and the dead man carried them down to the floor with him in a pool of the darkest blood that Spencer had ever seen. Rocky leaped in surprise at the gunfire, then cocked his head and studied Stephen Ackblom. He sniffed him as if the scent was far different from any he had encountered before. As Spencer stared down at his dead father, he was aware of Rocky gazing up curiously at him. Then the dog joined Ellie at the door. When at last he went to the door too, Spencer was afraid to look at Ellie.
"I wondered if you would actually be able to do it," she said. "If you hadn't, I'd have had to, and the recoil would have hurt like hell with this arm."
He met her eyes. She wasn't trying to make him feel better about what he had done. She had meant what she'd said.
"I didn't enjoy it," he said.
I would have.
I don't think so.
Immensely.
I didn't hate doing it either.
Why should you? You have to stomp a cockroach when you get a chance.
How's your shoulder?
Hurts like hell, but it's not bleeding all that much.
She flexed her right hand, wincing.
I'll still be able to work the computer keyboard with both hands. I just hope to God I can work it fast enough.
The three of them hurried through the depopulated catacombs toward the blue room, the yellow vestibule, and the strange world above.
Roy had no pain. In fact, he could feel nothing at all,
which made it easier for him to play dead. He feared that they would finish him off if they realized he was alive. Spencer Grant, a.k.a. Michael Ackblom, was indisputably as insane as his father and capable of any atrocity. Therefore, Roy closed his eyes and used his paralysis to his advantage. After the singular opportunity that he had given the artist, Roy was disappointed in the man, such blithe treachery. More to the point, Roy was disappointed in himself. He had badly misjudged Stephen Ackblom. The brilliance and sensitivity that he had perceived in the artist had been no illusion. However, he had allowed himself to be deceived into believing that what he saw was the whole story. He had never glimpsed the dark side. Of course, he was always so quick to like people, just as the artist had said, and he was acutely aware of everyone suffering within moments of having met them. That was one of his virtues, and he would not have wanted to be a less tender-hearted person. He had been deeply moved by Ackblom's plight, such a witty and talented man locked in a cell for the rest of his life. Compassion had blinded Roy to the full truth. He still had hope of coming out of this alive and seeing Eve again. He didn't feel as though he were dying. Of course, he was unable to feel much of anything at all below the neck. He took comfort from the knowledge that if he were to die, he would go to the great cosmic party and be welcomed by so many friends whom he'd sent ahead of him with great tenderness. For Eve's sake, he wanted to live, but to some extent he longed for that higher plane where there was a single sex, where everyone had the same radiant blue skin color, where every person was perfectly beautiful in an androgynous blue way, where no one was dumb, no one too smart, where everyone had identical living quarters and wardrobes and footwear, where there was high-quality mineral water and fresh fruit for the asking. He would have to be introduced to everyone he had known in this world because he wouldn't recognize them in their new, perfect, identical blue bodies. That seemed sad, not to see people as they had been. On the other hand, he wouldn't want to spend eternity with his dear mother. If he had to look at her face all bashed in, as it had been just after he had sent her on to that better place. He tried speaking and found that his voice had returned.
Are you dead, Stephen, or are you faking?
Across the black room, slumped against a black wall, the artist didn't answer.
I think they're gone and won't be coming back, so if you're faking, it's all clear now.
No reply.
Well, then you've gone over, and all the bad in you was left here. I'm sure you're full of remorse now and wish you'd been more compassionate toward me. So if you could exert a little of your cosmic power, reach through the veil and work a little miracle so I can walk again, I believe that would be appropriate.
The room remained silent. He still couldn't feel anything below his neck.
I hope I don't need the services of a spirit channeler to get your attention, Roy said. That would be inconvenient.
Silence. Stillness. Cold white light in a tight cone blazing down through the center of that encapsulating blackness.
I'll just wait. I'm sure that reaching through the veil takes a lot of effort.
Any moment now, a miracle. Opening the driver's door of the pickup, Spencer was suddenly afraid that he had lost the keys. They were in his jacket pocket. By the time Spencer got behind the wheel and started the engine, Rocky was in the back seat and Ellie was already in the other front seat. The motel pillow was across her thighs, the laptop was on the pillow, and she was waiting to power up the computer. When the engine turned over and Ellie switched on the laptop, she said,
"Don't go anywhere yet.
We're sitting ducks here.
I've got to get back into Godzilla."
Godzilla?
The system I was in before we got out of the truck.
What's Godzilla?
As long as we're just sitting here, they probably won't do anything except watch us and wait. But as soon as we start to move, they'll have to act. And I don't want them coming at us until we're ready for them.
What's Godzilla?
Shh. I have to concentrate.
Spencer looked out his side window at the fields and hills. The snow didn't glow as brightly as it had earlier because the moon was waning. He had been trained to spot clandestine surveillance in both urban and rural settings, but he could see no signs of the agency observers, though he knew they were out there. Ellie's fingers were busy. Keys clicked. Data and diagrams played across the screen. Focusing on the winterscape once more, Spencer remembered snow forts, castles, tunnels, carefully tamped sled runs. More important, in addition to the physical details of old playgrounds in the snow, he faintly recalled the joy of laboring on those projects and of setting out on those boyhood adventures. Recollections of innocent times, childhood fantasies, happiness. They were faint memories, faint but perhaps recoverable with practice. For a long time, he hadn't been able to remember even a single moment of his childhood with fondness. The events in that July not only had changed his life forever thereafter, but had changed his perception of what his life had been like before the owl, the rats, the scalpel, and the knife. Sometimes his mother had helped him build castles of snow. He remembered times when she'd gone sledding with him. They especially enjoyed going out after dusk. The night was so crisp. The world so mysterious in black and white, with billions of stars above, you could pretend that the sled was a rocket and you were off to other worlds. He thought of his mother's grave in Denver, and he suddenly wanted to go there for the first time since his grandparents had moved him to San Francisco. He wanted to sit on the ground beside her and reminisce about nights when they had gone sledding under a billion stars, when her laughter had carried like music across the white fields. Rocky stood on the floor in back, paws planted on the front seat, and craned his head forward to lick affectionately at the side of Spencer's face. He turned and stroked the dog's head and neck.
Mr. Rocky Dog, more powerful than a locomotive, faster than a speeding bullet, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, terror of all cats and Dobermans. Where did that come from,
He scratched behind the dog's ears.
Then, with fingertips, he gently explored the crushed cartilage that ensured the left ear would always droop.
Way back in the bad old days, did the person who did this to you look anything like the man back there in the black room? Or did you recognize a scent? Do the evil ones smell alike, pal?
Rocky luxuriated in the attention.
Mr. Rocky Dog, furry hero, ought to have his own comic book. Show us some teeth, give us a thrill.
Rocky just panted.
Come on, show us some teeth,
Spencer said, growling and skinning his lips back from his own teeth. Rocky liked the game, bared his own teeth, and they went grrrr at each other, muzzle to muzzle.